I shall never forget it as long as I live. The officer was going down the trench. Anybody who didn't go in was shot on sight for cowardice. We went over and we crawled. If you stood up, you were dead.
World War I, or the First World War, or the so-called Great War, was a global conflict originating in Europe that lasted from the 28th of July 1914 to the 11th of November 1918. It led to the mobilization of more than 70 million military personnel, including 60 million Europeans, making it one of the largest wars in history. World War I was also one of the deadliest conflicts in history, with an estimated 8.5 million combatant deaths and 13 million civilian deaths as a direct result of the war. In its aftermath, the related 1918 Spanish flu pandemic caused another 17 to 100 million deaths worldwide.
These are staggering figures. 70 million people on the battlefield fighting. These are the fighters, not the countries. The countries, obviously, if you include them, that's literally more than half of almost of the world's population. And around 10 million people died in the battles of World War I. It was also the first time that modern technology was used with such savagery. It was the first time that chemical weapons were invented. It was the first time that you had airplanes basically using guns and firing bombs from airplanes. This didn't happen until World War I. And this basically led to the development of munitions and more dangerous explosives. The war lasted 4 years. And at the end of the Great War in 1918, the largest empires of the world, or I should say, four of the largest empires of the world, ceased to exist.
World War I is often framed from a European point of view. Its consequences for the Muslim Ummah, however, are no less significant.
Four of the largest empires in the world were completely decimated. The first of them, the German Empire. It became a small country called Germany. It used to be a large empire with a dynasty. The second of them, the Russian Empire. Once again, this was a large empire with a dynasty. Then it became a smaller country. The third of them, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. This was completely decimated. It didn't even remain Austro-Hungarian. It was actually split up into a number of smaller countries. And most importantly, the Ottoman Empire.
After a lengthy trajectory of decline in the Ottoman Khilafah, as well as the success of the toxic calls of secularism and nationalism in making inroads into the Muslim Ummah, World War I was the moment when the enemies of Islam saw the moment being ripe for the dismemberment of the Muslim lands. In present memorials and anniversaries of World War I, the huge loss of life for humanity in the war is often lamented. However, the role of the instigators and beneficiaries of this conflict is often overlooked.
There's a huge wealth in India. And if you think about it, the route from Europe to India, either today even, goes through the Suez Canal and the Red Sea and round the Indian Ocean to India, or across land, across Turkey, across the Middle East, and then to what is now currently Pakistan and then India. And that was the way you could get there. So whoever controlled that Middle East region was strategically in a position to fundamentally undermine Britain's interests in India. So we have a situation that the Ottoman Khilafah was the entity in that region that was controlling it and that was powerful. And unfortunately, in the time that the British ruled India and occupied India, the Ottoman Khilafah was weak. It was of its weakest phase. Mm-hmm. Even then, it was still a world power.
By the time World War I began in the summer of 1914, the Ottoman Empire was nothing but a shell of its former self. Its former lands in Europe were now gone, as the Greeks, Bulgarians, Serbs and Bosnians were all either independent or under European control. all that was left was the predominantly Turkish lands of Anatolia and the Arab lands south of it, including present-day Syria, Iraq, Palestine, and Saudi Arabia. The Ottomans were also deprived of their brightest star, Sultan Abdul Hamid II, who, though still alive at this point, had been deposed and had been confined to house arrest in a palace. Sultan Abdul Hamid had been wary of being drawn into any unnecessary conflict for decades, but without his political acumen, the Ottomans were drawn into a conflict that held nothing for them except destruction. The Khilafah still existed, but only with many of its powers stripped away by the coup ringleaders.
Even though in 1914 the Sultan said he's going to remain neutral, circumstances changed, and it is said that the inner court, the Young Turks, maneuvered the Sultan, and the Grand Vizier, the Pasha, the Grand Vizier, his name was Said Pasha, is the title, Said Pasha, along with the Minister of War, and the Minister of War is probably the guiltiest culprit here, his name is Enver Pasha. So Said Pasha and Enver Pasha, they entered into a secret agreement with the Germans without the permission of the Sultan, without the permission of Sultan Mehmed V, and they formed what is called now an Ottoman-German alliance in August of 1914. Around 6 months before the war, after the war began. So the movers and shakers formed a treaty with the Kaiser, and eventually the Sultan had no choice but to publicly support this alliance. So in 1914, November, the Sultan Mehmed V, for the very last time in our history, issued a call for jihad. Literally, because the Khalifa has the right to call for jihad, as you know in Islamic law. The only person who has the right to call for offensive jihad is the Khalifa. So for the very last time in our history, in November 1914, Sultan Mehmed V proclaimed jihad against the Allied forces. And therefore, once the Ottomans have been dragged in, now the Allied forces can attack the Ottomans, fair square. When you've declared jihad against us, obviously they're going to attack back. And the Ottomans, it was only a matter of time before the Ottomans would be invaded, and that is exactly what happened. A few months later, in April 1915, Britain and France launched a joint attack against the Ottomans with the express aim of conquering Istanbul. So for the first time, Western powers are attacking Ottoman lands, and this became known as the Gallipoli campaign.
And Abdul Hamid was really concerned about World War I. When they asked him about how could we have got out of World War I, he said, firstly, we should never have got involved in World War I. But he said, if we were to get involved in World War I, you should have stayed on the side of the British never lose. Right? But they didn't. Then they came to, how do we get out? He goes, we can't, it's too late now. We're just going to have to see what happens.
One indication of the grave consequences that this war had for the Ummah were that Muslims found themselves in some cases inadvertently on opposite sides of the conflict. The Ottoman Khilafah had entered the war with the Germans, or Central Powers, but during the war some 2.5 million Muslims were drafted for the Allies and were drawn from countries like India, Algeria, Morocco and Tunisia.
The Muslims in India were part of the British Army, so they fought with the British alongside them, against the Germans and the Ottomans, what they call the Turk. I can tell you what the problem with that was, and I'm not going to quote myself on this. I'll quote a very famous English Muslim, Muhammad Marmaduke Pickthall, the famous translator of Quran. And in 1922, he was in India after the war, 4 years after the end of the war. He was in India. He was in Bombay. He addressed a conference there, basically saying, "The reality is that Hindustan's Muslims sided with Britain in the war against the Turks." And he said, "I too am in that boat," so in the same boat. So he acknowledged that living in Britain at the time, he didn't do enough. Actually, he did more than most. Allah give him rahmah. He said, "I joined the battle on behalf of Britain. In the promises made to us, it was clearly expressed that it would not be against the welfare of Islam and the Jaziratul Arab. But with our help, Britain was victorious over the Khilafatul Muslimin, and now it's our obligation to restore the Jaziratul Arab to the Khilafatul Muslimin." So he's arguing in 1922 to the Indian Muslims that You and I both were on the side of Britain against the Khilafah.
As the fighting raged on, the British were instrumental in backdoor deals that sought to imagine a post-World War I new order. Having seen the scourge of nationalism splinter the Ottoman lands even before the war, it was now exploited to its maximum effect. The Ottomans were cast as Turks who supposedly did not have the required spiritual pedigree to lead the Muslim world.
People coming from certain countries telling me basically that the Ottomans, the Turks, as they call them, that they actually did the same as the European colonialists did later. Now, I asked them to compare indeed what the French did in North Africa or what the British did in certain countries, if they really did the same to the Muslim world as the Ottomans did to the Muslim world. I mean, honestly, is this a question? Of course they didn't. If you just look at Algeria, if you just look at what the French did in a short period of time they were there, in a shorter period than the Ottomans were in Algeria, they destroyed an entire country, a nation. They destroyed their culture and even language. These people in Algeria, if you consider educated Algerians, they speak better French than they speak Arabic. Who of these people speak Turkish? If the Turks were the same, then why don't you speak Turkish?
As early as 1915, the British began making overtures to the Hashemite governor of Makkah, Sharif Hussein, to establish his own Arab kingdom if he sided with them and revolted against the Ottomans under whom he was serving. The British sent the infamous T.E. Lawrence, also known as the Lawrence of Arabia, to Hussein to convince him to revolt and provide him with huge amounts of money and weapons. A key rationale for choosing the Sharif was his sacred lineage as a descendant of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The British seeking to exploit this to present him as being more fit to lead the Ummah than the Ottomans. Through to and fro correspondence from the British, the Sharif was convinced. His support secured, the British moved on to sell the same land they promised to the Sharif two more times. In the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the British and the French secretly conspired by literally drawing lines on a map of the Middle East to decide who would control which areas of the Muslim world after the war. These were the very lands promised to the Sharif for his grand Arab kingdom. It did not stop there. The British simultaneously promised Palestine, which was also promised to the Sharif, to the Zionist movement for the establishment of a national Jewish home in the infamous Balfour Declaration. The Hungarian British author and journalist Arthur Kussler described this declaration as one nation solemnly promising to a second nation the country that belonged to a third. Details of the secret Sykes-Picot deal were leaked during the World War I period, yet it did not seem to deter Arab trust in British promises.
They managed to smooth it over, believe it or not, and wallahi how naive the Muslims were. They managed to smooth it over and lie about it and say, oh no, don't worry, we still promise to you, still valid. And the Arabs to the very end believed them, to the very end, right until the peace conference of 1992. Now in this agreement, England got control over Jordan and Iraq and Palestine, what is now Palestine and Israel. France was given the southeastern part of Turkey and Syria, and Russia was promised Istanbul and most of central Turkey and what is today Armenia. So three separate treaties going on regarding the same land. Look at how double dealing, how duplicitous, how hypocritical, how backstabbing the Brits were here. Three different agreements.
With British encouragement, a group of Arabs from the Hijaz revolted against their brothers in Islam and sided with the British. From 1914 to 1918, the Arabs harassed the Ottoman forces throughout the Arab world. The consequences for the lands of the Ummah and Khilafah control over them were disastrous. Because of the Arab revolt, the British were easily able to conquer Iraq, Palestine, and Syria from the Ottoman Empire.
And the only way, again, this is talking about Muslims who fought on the side of Britain, the only way the British managed to get Al-Quds was by getting Sharif Hussein in Mecca to rebel against the Ottomans, thereby creating another front for them to have to fight and defend, which took away resources from Al-Quds, from Damascus, from Baghdad, which they weren't inevitably going to lose. I mean, by 1917, the British were surprised that the Ottomans were still in the war.
Yeah.
They were kind of thinking they were going to fall on year one. And they were still very much in it. In fact, in 1917, the British weren't even sure they were going to win.
Like a tesbih counter losing its beads, Ottoman lands began to fall.
So 1918 becomes a fault line year because the Arab provinces become independent from the Ottomans. The Arab provinces are now lost. And this is a huge shock to the Ottoman system, the loss of the Arab provinces. Actually, what's interesting is the Ottomans were more shocked at the loss of Baghdad than they were at the loss of Mecca and Medina, which surprises some people sometimes. But Baghdad was like the pivot for the entrance to Mecca and Medina. Lose Baghdad, strategically, you lose it all. And Baghdad was the city of the Abbasids. That was heavy in their mind because they knew that that's a loss of power. That's a loss of center of power. So in some ways, you can't get to Mecca and Medina if you can't get via Baghdad. So once the British took Baghdad, they knew we're in a mess.
On December the 11th, 1917, British General Edmund Allenby marched triumphantly into Jerusalem on foot. He is reported to have announced that the wars of the Crusades were now complete.
From Egypt, he launches into Gaza, into Jaffa, and there he fought the German and the Ottoman forces. Eventually, he reaches the holy city of Jerusalem, Baitul Maqdis, on the 9th of December 1917, giving the British Prime Minister his Christmas gift that he wanted, because he said, "I went to Jerusalem before Christmas." In March 1917, the British captured Baghdad. By December 1917, they're in Jerusalem. And by October 1918, they conquer Damascus. It was only a matter of time now before the rest of the Muslim lands fall. And on November 13th, 1918, they invade Istanbul. French and British forces invade Istanbul. And Istanbul falls to the Allies.
The losses were grave, and the physical dismemberment of the Muslim world was complete.
Mecca gone, Medina gone, Aqsa gone, Baghdad gone, Cairo gone. This is really hurting the resolve of the Ottoman armies, right? Really shocking their system. There was a locust infection, malaria. And so some Muslims started to believe that Allah was punishing them. You know, what's going on here? Like, are we being punished by Allah?
It is truly symbolic, in my humble opinion, that out of all of the magnificent and glorious capitals of the Muslim lands, Baghdad and Damascus and Istanbul, all of them, not symbolically, were literally conquered by the Allies. Literally, Western troops, Allenby and two of them, Allenby wasn't in Istanbul, but Western troops literally entered in to Damascus and Baghdad and Istanbul, and then, of course, Jerusalem, the holiest of holy in that region. And there is no doubt in my mind that in terms of political humiliation, this was one of the lowest points in the entire history of the Ummah. Perhaps the only disaster politically that was bigger than this was the Mongols. Wallahi, can you imagine? Every single capital of the Muslim lands physically captured by the Allies, and Jerusalem, the holiest of holy. It's only a matter of time before, obviously, the end is near. And the Allied forces eventually made similar conquests against Germany. And eventually, Germany agrees to surrender.
Shockwaves spread across Muslim lands. A painful new reality had taken hold in the heartland of the Ummah. All that was left was to pick up the pieces.